on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Tune in to KBOO tonight at 8 o'clock for Squirrel Snow, the one show where we broadcast galactic awareness and animal awareness, where sometimes we have fascinating conversations with experts, authors, activists, and the fields of animal awareness and galactic awareness. And a lot of the time we play amazing music that could effectively raise your frequency of consciousness. Yes, that is Squirrel Snow, tonight at 8 o'clock, here on your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.
KBOO FM, Portland, power to the people.
Hello, and you are listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350 Climate Action. Our show presents environmental and climate stories from a social justice frame, featuring voices not necessarily heard on mainstream media. Welcome, I am Jessica Aldridge. On today's show, Indigenous Voices from the Northeast, Past, Present, and Future. Host Carrie Kim will be interviewing Jennifer Lee, Northern Narragansett educator and board member of the Nolimbika Project, an organization dedicated to honoring the Northeastern tribal heritage of the Connecticut River Valley. The word Nolimbika is Abenaki for the calm waters between the rapids. Jennifer Lee is a 68-year-old grandmother who learned of her native heritage as an adult and has spent her years studying the true history and culture of the Northeast Woodland Indigenous peoples. She has been sharing her knowledge at schools and historic sites by holding classes in her Eastern Conical Wigwam. She is a co-producer of the 10-part film series Indigenous Voices, and she has been a bark basket maker for 40 years.
We begin the show with the trailer from the video series Indigenous Voices, Stories from the Connecticut River Valley of Massachusetts, produced by the Nolimbika Project in collaboration with Turning Tide Films, directed by Robbie Lepzer, produced by Jennifer Lee, Northern Narragansett, our guest. Voices include Jennifer, Monica Alexander of the Mi'kmaq, Liz Coldwind Santana Kaiser of the Nipmuc, Wes Picor of Massachusetts, and Andre Strong Bearheart Gaines Jr. of the Nipmuc.
It's important to remember that European people have only been here for 400 years. Native people, Indian people, Indigenous people have been here for 10,000 years. In learning about what was life like here before the Europeans came here, try to erase everything. Erase all the roads, all the cars, all the trucks, all the buildings, all the grocery stores, okay? Grocery stores do not exist.
Every time I put in a quill, I feel very proud and very happy. Art is directly connected to all Native people. Doing art is a way to explain origins, where people came from.
My name is Liz Coldwind Santana Kaiser. I'm 71 years old. I am an elder and a councilwoman on the Chibonagogabog Band of Nipmuc Indians, which is my tribe. We are still here. We are still alive. We still exist. And we still carry on our traditions and our culture.
This is my church. that's where everything goes on for me, and out in nature, that's where my spiritual part comes from, my beliefs. That's where I go to become one with everything. I feel that this is what I was supposed to do. I'm giving the honor back to nature that I feel that it gave me. Maybe me carving it is keeping that beauty for other people to see what I see. There's an emotion in here, so it's like I'm taking something out of my heart and putting it there for everybody to see. Maybe they won't see what part of me is in it, but I know it's there.
We're out here today tanning hides and remembering these old ways. For me, it's of the utmost importance to be able to teach whatever knowledge I have to all these young ones that are around me. My nieces, my nephews were here. That makes me really happy that I know that I've given them enough knowledge to be able to keep a tradition alive. It's really important for me to be able to teach these young ones that these skills aren't lost.
Aloha, this is Carrie Kim. Listeners, thank you for joining us and our esteemed guest, Jennifer Lee, Northern Narragansett grandmother, bark basket maker, and culture bearer, here to provide histories, insights, and perspectives of Native peoples of the Northeast. Jennifer grew up without knowledge of her Native ancestry, which compelled her to seek out the true history and culture of the Northeast Woodlands Indigenous peoples as an independent researcher. For roughly 30 years, she has held classes in her Eastern conical wigwam to tell the stories of Northeast Native peoples and share her cultural knowledge. Many of us who are settlers here know precious little about the depth of pre-contact histories, given the numerous nations and tribes that continue to exist on this continent. The stories of Indigenous peoples and the ancestors of Turtle Island insist upon our attention now, that we might act on their behalf, Mother Earth, and future generations. Firstly, we would like to thank the Tongva ancestors of these lands. We appreciate all of the legacy of their stewardship and their continued presence here, and we invite everyone to act on behalf of local First Nations wherever you live, and we honor the Tongva relatives who live here and all of their extended relatives. This is a paraphrase introduction originally written by Jennifer Lee. Maybe it was a co-authored. Our guest today: Native people inhabited the Connecticut River Valley of Western Massachusetts for more than 10,000 years. It is the homeland of many First People, all related to one another. They are called the Sokoki, the Pocumtuck, the Nonotuck, Waronoko, and Agawam. There are many other tribes who visited and still visit this Native homeland. Among them are the Abenaki, the Nipmuc, the Wampanoag, the Narragansett, the Mohican, the Pequot, Mohican, and Mohawk. These tribes are recognized today by states or the federal government as sovereign nations. Historically, tribes gathered in this valley to trade, to fish, to plant, to participate in sacred ceremonies, to reunite with family, and perhaps to find a spouse. Where are the Pocumtuck, the Nonotuck, the Roanoko, and Agawam peoples today? During the wars waged in the colonial period, they were driven from this valley. They blended into the Abenaki, the Nipmuc, and the Mohican tribes across the Northeast. Often they integrated into the settler communities. Some were herbal doctors, basket makers, and carvers. They dressed like their European descendant neighbors, but kept the fire of their culture alive. Much has been written about the last of the Indigenous people in the Northeast, that they are gone and extinct. But this is not true. Native people had children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. Their spirits, their memory, and their descendants are here, living among us. We invite you to listen to some of their stories and to act on their behalf. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you, Carrie. I'm delighted to be here. And thank you for reading that introduction. It was written by David Brulé. It was like a co-author thing. And I think it kind of summarizes our area. It's just a beginning to understand.
So I would first like to ask if there's any particular way you would like to open our conversation.
I would just like to give a thank you to the Native families that have kept the culture, the traditions, the history, the worldview, the language.
We honor them. No, I would love for you to talk about your own journey to reclaim your heritage. And I'm not sure if you were even aware that you had Native ancestry, but I know it was something like 20 years, right, in the journeying to find your heritage, your peoples. And I was wondering if you could speak to that.
Sure. My grandmother was a historian. And as a little girl, I asked her what river we were crossing. And she said, well, they call it the Thames River, but it's really the Pequot River. And there was also a statue of John Mason who massacred a Pequot village in Mystic, Connecticut. And as a little girl, I said, Grandma, who is that man on the horse? Who is the statue? And she said, that's nobody. And then as an adult, I took my kids to that statue. What is this statue about in Mystic? And we read about John Mason. And my daughter was 9 years old at the time. And she said, this is terrible. There's a statue of the man who annihilated this Indian village. And she wrote the town a letter at nine.
I love it.
Go decades later, and I find out, okay, we have Narragansett heritage. Some of our ancestors were Narragansett. And as an adult, I went to this. It was like a play where they talked about moving that statue. The statue was moved from that place. Mm-hmm. So that's just a little example. You know, my grandmother said that Christopher Columbus was an absolute scoundrel. And at the time, of course, you know, I thought that's what everybody's grandma says, but that's not what everyone's grandma's saying. And in school, in grammar school, I think it was seventh grade, a boy in school came up to me and said, you know, everything they told us about the Indians is a lie, right? And that just stuck with me. And so even before I found out it was part of my heritage, mm-hmm. I've always been driven. I want to hear from Native authors. I want to try to learn really what did happen here. And in finding out, in learning, then my neighbors started asking me to come to the schools and teach. And I kept saying, well, I'm not like educated at college. And they were like, well, we don't have anybody else that can come and talk to the kids. So I started out by sharing with the kids what I was finding out about how Native people dressed in the 1700s. They didn't just go from deerskin to today. I've gone to many conferences as I could. We used to have a Eastern Indian Historical Conference in Ohio that I would go to. The Native American Institute of the Hudson River Valley was a great series of conferences put on by non-Native people who lived in the Albany area, but they reached out to the Mohicans from Wisconsin that were originally in the Albany area. And we just heard papers from college students and listened to people that could tell us about the natural history of the area and just like that, just trying to learn and also going to powwows. Powwows are really educational. And to celebrate the culture.
What words of encouragement might you have for anyone trying to rediscover their Indigenous heritage, where like you, it's part of them, but they may never have known anything about their life ways?
My words to those people is that, first of all, assume that what's in your head is stereotypes and wrong information, and seek out the correct information, especially from present day Native authors. Go to present day Native educational gatherings. Figure that you have to learn and don't ever give up. Sometimes it takes a long time to find your connection. And, you know, some people can be discouraging, but it's like an Abenaki elder said to me, Molly Keating, she said, every drop of Indian blood is precious. Mm-hmm. And she was always very encouraging. Learn, seek this out, find your ways, find your people, find out who they were. And sometimes that's hard for people, like especially in Vermont, we had the eugenics project where if you were Native, you were sterilized against your will. I mean, so a lot of people quit saying they were Native. And also, in the present day in this area, there's a really horrific statue of a Western Native man that's gigantic and is like a caricature. Things like that. Like, my kids were embarrassed when I would pick them up after school to go to a powwow. They would ask me to park my car where the kids couldn't see it because I had the wigwam poles on the top of the car. So I didn't want to be stand out, or, you know, at that time in the 80s, it wasn't something people were really bragging about, let's say.
Right. And has that changed for them now? Is it something, a source of pride instead? I mean, what is it for them now?
It's different. And I think they identify in their own way, but it's still, for them, it's not a major part of their life. But I know many people whose kids and grandkids totally embrace the culture.
And it may be something that comes to them later too. We never know, right down the line. Right. I wanted to ask you now to go back to the history. We did speak a little bit in the intro, but it really doesn't cover any amount of history really for how much has happened. You know, being on the West Coast, it is so important for us to remember how much later contact happened here compared to the East. And you described it as a tidal wave that began in the East and then moved west, but maybe the intensity lessened across the way of that kind of tsunami. I'm wondering if you could paint a picture of what it was like in the Northeast pre-contact.
Pre-contact, the cornfields were 1,500 acres in size. The food storage pits, some of them were 20 feet in diameter, 12 feet deep. Some of them were lined with clay that was fire hardened in place, like a giant bowl where they stored dried fish and corn and nuts and berries. People used the land much differently than we do today. Even with our cars, we don't travel as much as people did in the pre-contact times. Mm-hmm. There was a better road system here. When I say road system, I mean trails. Mm-hmm. There were more trails here to take people north, south, east, and west than any in Europe. In fact, all most of our roads today follow those trails that were made by moccasin Indian feet for 10,000 years of travel. And those trails were made to go not in the quickest way possible, but in a way so that you could travel for a day, which was about 18 miles, and have a good place to camp or fish, and where you wouldn't be going up steep hills because families travel together, and where you wouldn't be going through bogs. There are also these stone features that are still all over this land. One of the best books about them is called Manitou. And there's another book, which one of our elders doesn't like. It's called Land of a Thousand Cairns, which is a Scottish term. But they catalog the stone features, which if you're not familiar with them, you might just say that's a pile of rocks. And when you start to understand the forms, the triangles, you realize, and there's a whole movie series on this, that these are not colonial stone features. And the fact that there are so many all over the place. The ones that are left are the ones that haven't been destroyed by buildings. So, but still here on the East, you know, the Wampanoags live on their homeland. The Mohegans live in their homeland, in their original homeland. And it's quite astounding because, like you said, contact happened so much earlier. The thing is that not all Indian people responded the same way to contact. Some people assimilated, some people intermarried, passed as white. Other people stayed native, married native, kept their culture and their identity intact. And the further you get into the country, it's very different. In the more rural areas like today, you don't have big gathering places. And I don't think that in pre-contact times, they had big gathering places. So you have just a different kind of a lifestyle. But travel, I mean, for instance, Chief Greylock, an Abenaki man in the 1700s, he was born in Warrenoko, Mass., which is Westfield, Mass., but he was prominent in Missisquoi, Vermont, which is northern Vermont, and he went back and forth all the time, and it wasn't with a car.
Right.
He was walking. Yes, and we have examples of Native people living to 121 years old who could walk 10 miles a day at that age.
What do people need to know about pre-contact times?
I think the most important thing is that there is nothing primitive about the way Native people lived pre-contact. It was quite sophisticated and quite sustainable. And not perfect. Like you said, people warred against each other and had problems. And people are people. Mm-hmm. In any group of people, you have all kinds of people. But there was such a movement to trivialize Native culture, to make it sound barbaric, to make it sound less than, and it's just not true. The Native mm-hmm. herbalists still hold the medicines that are used in modern society from the herbs. Travel was amazing. People all over New England had Rama Chert, which is a stone that made really good arrowheads that came from mm-hmm. the Arctic Sea. Mm-hmm. The Arctic Sea, to navigate the Arctic Sea in canoes.
That's amazing.
Without a GPS, they knew right. much more. And so, you know, with the genocide that happened on the people and the culture, part of that genocide has been to relegate Native technology to inferior to European, and it's just not true. Mm-hmm. And I think what we're learning also,
it seems also important to recognize it's a spiritual technology. You know, it's a connected technology. It's not something divorced from a spirit essence.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the main different viewpoints. Native people were a part of the land, and the land is part of us. The European viewpoint, especially at time of contact, was the land is an object to take. But for Native people, it is a relationship.
Jennifer, this is a good time for us to take a break, and then we'll come back and speak a bit more about those original colonizers who came on the Mayflower.
Hey, listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying Eco Justice Radio. Stay connected by subscribing to Eco Justice Radio on all major podcast apps and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, to check out previous shows and guests. Listen to extended episodes and get connected with us on social media. Today, you are listening to Indigenous Voices from the Northeast, Past, Present, and Future, with host Carrie Kim and guest Jennifer Lee, Northern Narragansett educator and board member of the Nolambika Project.
Few people know that the tradition of Thanksgiving was invented during the Civil War by President Abraham Lincoln in October 1863, when he proclaimed Thanksgiving a national holiday to unite the Union. Thereafter, the myth of the Pilgrims and the Indians was constructed. The Wampanoag version of the Harvest Festival, with the English settlers, as a day of mourning for a land taken away, a culture subverted, and a people disappeared from epidemic and massacre.
So Jennifer, I wanted to ask you, you had spoken about the original colonizers who came over on the Mayflower, and that half of them died in that first winter. And eventually those 52 or so people became 20,000 in short order. And then after that, 60,000 Puritans soon arrived with a duty to conquer Indians. Despite the invasion, can you share how Native peoples helped the early colonizers? Because it's ironic to think that without them, you know, they wouldn't have ever survived, and they could have killed them. That's not what they chose to do. Could have slaughtered them entirely, right? They were not acclimated to life here.
Yeah. So there's lots of examples, Native people feeding the Europeans, bringing corn to them. We had a mural made of the 50 canoes that left Pocumtuck or present-day Deerfield and brought 500 bushels of corn to the starving settlers in Connecticut after they were engaged in the Pequot War. So when I look at the Connecticut River today, I see those 50 canoes full of corn. Mm. There's many examples. There's a Quidamog who brought corn to Boston. He carried a bushel and a half on his back and walked to Boston with it. And also Massasoit, the great sachem of the Wampanoag people, when he met, you know, he had watched these Mayflower settlers. And the thing is, before the Mayflowers, there were some people that came from Europe that were unscrupulous, that captured Native people, enslaved them, did horrible things to them. That was already in the history. But what Massasoit saw was women and children. Mm-hmm. And the way I heard it described is that, in a way, Massasoit invited the Mayflower settlers to be some of his own people. Which would mean at that time, you settlers, give me some of your corn and what you have, and I distribute it to the older people and the weak people, and I will protect your people and you protect my people. But the people coming from Europe were thinking, obtaining land, buying land, Now, what the commoners thought compared to what the people in charge or the money people thought, I think were really two different things. The people that came on the Mayflower, what choices did they have? They were subjects of their king. They were burnt for having different ideas.
They were fleeing their own persecution.
Absolutely. But here's one of the big things that I think affected the way things worked out. Because I always wonder, well, why didn't those people become more involved with the native communities already established? One thing was that the native communities had lower populations because of diseases. But another thing was this teaching called the Papal Edicts. Mm-hmm. And the Papal Edicts that came stated that if a person is not Christian, they're not human, and that's why you can kill them and steal from them. And then came the idea of the right of conquest. The right of conquest is that if you overwhelm people and take what's theirs, now it's yours. And the right of conquest was used pretty recently in courts against the Seneca people. So, and that's something that I was asking the third graders at the school I was at yesterday. I was like, do you really think the law of the land should be that if you overwhelm and take something that belongs to people, that's yours? And every kid except one, mm-hmm. there was one kid that said, yeah, yeah. And every other kid said, no, that shouldn't be the law of the land. So I feel like we're just untangling this 400 years later. So those things.
Dehumanizing, right? You need to dehumanize the person so that you can take, that you can kill and sort of mandate yourself to do these things.
Exactly. And I feel like the mascots are a continuation of that.
Tokenizing and trivializing. You know, as an Indigenous person, can you explain the importance of remembering or carrying the past? Because on this continent, there's, you know, in the settler colonial way, it's so much you forget the past, leave the past, don't be, you know, troubled by the past, you have to let it go. And so there's a big difference in understanding or like cosmological viewpoint of carrying the ancestors, carrying the dead. In what way should the past inform the present?
I love that question. I feel like first I have to identify that as a descendant of the Narragansetts, a northern Narragansett, I'm not enrolled in a federally recognized tribe or a state recognized tribe. So according to some people, I'm not an Indigenous person. Okay, there's a variety of opinions about that. So, mm-hmm. but I am a descendant. So the reason knowing the past is so important, how can you know what to do today if you don't know what happened? How can you know what is proper behavior, good behavior of a fellow human being if you don't know whose land you're standing on and what has happened here? Mm-hmm. How can you know what to do today if you don't understand the color of your skin gives you a certain privilege that others don't have? What are those privileges? So I just think it means everything, because in a way we represent our ancestors. Mm-hmm. So here we are together having this conversation. We are representing our ancestors.
What do you want people to know about Northeast Native peoples? And we've talked about how things become caricatures, or they could be romanticized. There's many different ways, but what do you want people to know, having researched and done so much study of heritage yourself?
Okay, here's an example of what I want people to know. I want people to know that Native people are still here, that there's 574 federally recognized tribes. It doesn't count. That doesn't include all the state recognized tribes or the descendant groups like myself. Now, I just am in contact with a person in a nearby town. They want to write the Indigenous part of their town, only pertaining to their town, which has only been in existence for a couple of hundred years. And their first draft basically said, there's no Native people ever been here and aren't now. So the thing is, you can't think about, this is why you need to know the past. If this town has only been in existence for 200 years, you need to understand, okay, which tribe's homeland is it? Because from the Atlantic to the Pacific is all Indian land. Right. This is Indian land. And none of it was obtained with honor mm-hmm. or legality. There was no legal representation for Native people at the land sales or whatever you call those. Mm-hmm. So you need to say, okay, I am living in this tribe's land, a traditional land, where all these things happened. And if I look, you have to look broader. what was happening around here. Because, see, there wasn't a town hall here to write down what happened here before 200 years. And if you're only thinking 200 years, we have 10,000, 15,000, 30,000 years of Indigenous history. Don't let the kids miss out on that, because it's awesome.
It is awesome. Momentum, of course, is growing around truth and reconciliation. And there are many people who are wanting to make some kind of reparations, whether personal or not, and to redress these atrocities and injustices and deceptions that have been inflicted upon Native peoples. And what do you suggest that people do who wish to honor and align with Native peoples?
Thank you, Carrie. First, I want to just reiterate that not all the settlers that came were hateful toward Native people. There were alliances. Even when the Cherokees were forced west, there were many people, non-Native people in New England, who protested that removal. Just not enough of them. And there's also fashion, and there's other parts of history besides war. I don't like to do history by the wars, but the wars happened and the genocide happened. So what can we do? Here's what one of my neighbors is doing. They are contributing a voluntary monthly amount to a local Native cultural center. It's called Oketeo, O-H-K-E-T-E-A-U. And it is a wonderful collaboration with our Commissioner of Indian Affairs for Western Massachusetts, with Nipmuc tribal members, and with a double-edged theater, which is a theater group in a local town that has made it possible for a place for Native people to come together and learn and act and learn all kinds of things. Because for decades, I've gone to Nipmuc social gatherings in the basement of a church that was borrowed for a day. So find that cultural center and give it some money. Monthly, it doesn't have to be a lot, because if everybody just gave a little bit, it would make a huge difference. And that also says a lot. So that's what people are doing here. They are making it possible, especially Native youth, to learn their culture, to make ways for that. So donating money is a really good way. I've heard of the real tax. I think that's what my neighbor is kind of doing.
Can you explain that, the real tax, for people who don't know?
Okay. The little I know about it is, it's a voluntary tax that you say, okay, I'm living on this tribe's land. So every month I'm going to give this much money to that tribe. And I hear it's been done to help tribal people regain some of their culturally significant and spiritual places. So that's one way. I mean, attending the Native cultural events is really educational and helpful, supporting Native artisans, and really speaking out about erasure and proper representation in your local area. It's huge.
We talk about the importance of pre-contact history of Indigenous peoples, but it seems equally important to discuss the pre-contact history of the colonizers. Because, for example, like in England, it's easy to forget that before they were invaded by the Romans, they had their own pagan traditions. There was Old English. It was very different than the English that's spoken today. Many spoke a Celtic language. They were descended from Germanic tribes. I mean, every culture has their indigeneity to return to, and it seems this is a unifying factor. You know, what was the culture before, whether it was religious indoctrination or what had happened? What did these cultures lose? What were their traumas that were inflicted upon them and then repeated here on this continent? So I wonder if you could comment on the importance of that for anyone who was of, you know, the descendants that came here.
Yes. Well, I have many ancestors part of the colonial invasion, and I wonder about them a lot. And I wonder, how did they get so far away from their pagan traditions? But it's funny, because I just met somebody who had the same last name as my grandmother's maiden name, and he said all his relatives speak Gaelic. And I was like, what? I had no, you know, so there are those traditions. That's definitely something that's happening with a lot of people, is trying to get back to those traditions and those earth-centered traditions. Yeah, but you know, those traditions are so intertwined with the land that you live on. That's a part of it. I think we can't undo what our ancestors have done, but we can face it and we can address it.
The land back movement continues to expand. You've already kind of talked a little bit about the real tax, and I know some nations are using that to be able to also secure land as well. for their life ways. And some people are voluntarily gifting or willing back lands to Native peoples. And there's also visions of returning public lands back into Native hands. What are your thoughts about land back and what movements around land back are happening in the Northeast that you've seen?
Well, I can tell you in the town next to me, there are about four buildings that are now part of that cultural center, Ocoteo. Mm-hmm. And that's very exciting because they have a presence, they have a name. So one of the things I hear about is Native people will say, well, it's not that we want to own land and pay all those taxes.
All right.
We need a place to harvest our cedar poles for our traditional wigwams and, you know, our ash for the baskets. And, you know, we need access to it. So that's mm-hmm. one of the things that's happening is access to land, which is wonderful.
Well, given all that you know about the histories of Indigenous peoples, what would you like to see happen in your lifetime?
I would like to see the high school down the road that's called Mohawk High School change its name and invite Mohawk people down to give a sharing and a dance, because the high school is called Mohawk High School, but people have no idea there's 30,000 Mohawk citizens just up in New York and Canada. In fact, there was even a college student at UMass that was saying, relating something that happened at the Mohawk High School, thinking it was Mohawk. You know, so I think just for people to learn about Native people, there's this wonderful book called Firsting and Lasting. Jeannie O'Brien wrote it about how much the historic narrative says, oh, this is the first white man born here, and this is the last Indian that was here. Okay, so this is continually in the narrative, and this is what my neighboring town is continuing to rebuild. The Mohicans have a tribal historic preservation office in Williamstown. Mm-hmm. They have so much to do and so few people to do it. There should be money. Money should be sent to them so that they can have historians and their tribal members come, and we need to meet each other again. Like, people still have these ideas about who Indian people are that are wacky
and misinformed, and they're not true. I mean, they have based on no experience. It's just based on something fictionalized or something they've gathered from media portrayals. Yes. You know, with many Indigenous elders that have passed in the spirit realm, decolonizing and re-indigenizing seems a huge imperative, with fewer elders to model ancestral ways. Now, one of my mentors, Stephen Jenkinson, says that elderhood is a function. I'm wondering what elderhood means to you and what is the significance of elders now?
Elders are so important. They hold the knowledge, but they hold the way that people relate to each other. And they are our teachers. And, you know, when just getting back a little bit to what I'd like to see happen, the Massachusetts seal needs to be changed. It is a colonizing seal. The flag needs to be changed. That's a real problem. And at the schools, there needs to be funding so that the elders can come to schools, mm-hmm. so that they can share with the kids, because that's one of the best ways to learn.
Well, know? I think that intergenerational piece of even knowing that there is a relationship you would want to have with elders. I mean, some people don't even realize what they don't know because they don't have any relationship with elders.
Right.
So they have their own perception of it, or that I don't need it. So Jennifer, we're going to take another break right here and we'll come back and speak a bit more about the value of elders.
Okay. Thank you.
Hey listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying Eco Justice Radio. Stay connected by subscribing to Eco Justice Radio on all major podcast apps and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, to check out previous shows and guests. Listen to extended episodes and get connected with us on social media. Today, you are listening to Indigenous Voices from the Northeast, past, present, and future, with host Carrie Kim and guest Jennifer Lee, Northern Narragansett educator and board member of the Nolambika Project.
King Philip, also known as Metacom, before launching King Philip's war on the inhabitants of New England, was quoted as saying, "The English who came first to this country were but a handful of people forlorn, poor, and distressed. My father, Massasoit, did all in his power to serve them. Others came, their numbers increased. My father's counselors urged him to destroy the English before they become strong enough to give law to the Indians and take away their country. My father was also the father to the English. He remained their friend. Experience shows that his counselors were right. The English disarmed my people. They tried them by their own laws and assessed damages my people could not pay. Sometimes the cattle of the English would come into cornfields of my people, for they did not make fences like the English. I must then be seized and confined till I sold another tract of my country for damages and costs. Thus tract after tract is gone, but a small part of the dominion of my ancestors remains. I am determined not to live till I have no country. From King Philip, the book Lives of Famous Indian Chiefs by Norman B. Wood, 1906.
We are the Kingfisher singers and dancers. We're going to be focused mostly on Northeastern style social dance songs. We are Eastern Proto-Algonquian speaking people and part of the sort of greater Algonquian language family speaking people. So we're very close relatives to the Mohican people just west of us, with the Pecumtuk people of this area, with the Nipmuc and the Narragansett, of course, being Leah's people, Niantic people, and of course, other related nations in the region. So these social dance songs, these traditional songs, they've been traded and shared for many, many generations. Songs make their rounds, they change, the styles change based on the nation that's singing them and how they're performing them, because of course we are living, moving people and we change over time, but we also hold those traditional values in those songs and we do the very best we can to pass them down to the next generation in the proper way.
So Jennifer, could you elaborate? I wanted to shift back to conversations on perceptions around land and the distinction between like the colonizers or European concept or English concept of property or land ownership and how Indigenous peoples relate to land as a commons or something to be shared.
Very important. Massasoit said something like, "What is this thing you call property? It can't be the earth, because the earth is our mother, providing food for all her children. The animals, the fish, the birds, the people, the streams and forests are for everyone to use. How can one person say it belongs only to them?" And the European people that came, the traders that ran the early stores, they were like, "Oh, we'll get this person indebted and then their land will be mine." There's a very different way of looking at it, but I think more and more people are understanding there's a healing relationship that comes when you're on the land.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of people's mental health problems come from being disassociated from the land.
Yes.
So the land is, you know, if you really think about the land as mother instead of resource, it's very different. And it's a shame that so many Indigenous people are in cities, but we all need that connection.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Definitely, there's a lot to discuss around that relationship to land and what has been severed for many people, you know, because as I was talking about with all cultures have their own indigeneity. You know, we began with the land. People were, whether they were tending to the land, had, you know, animal husbandry, whatever it was, their relationship, there was something very specific and connected. And it has, there is a big severance for many generations for peoples around the world. Even though Land Back is galvanizing action around the return of land to Native peoples, at the same time, there is land grabbing happening right now as we speak around the world. It's been happening. Fred Pierce, he's an author, and he wrote a book called Land Grabbers, which documents the land grabbing of corporations and countries and Wall Street billionaires and oil sheiks who've been buying and leasing vast tracts of land in Africa, Southeast Asia, South America, and Eastern Europe. We recognize the importance of food and water security, not just for human beings, but for all life. And I wonder if you can comment on what is still happening with this sort of this land grabbing. It's still kind of a manifest destiny, like perversion happening.
Well, you know, in the movie series Indigenous Voices, Tom Porter says that it used to be the kings and queens that owned everything, and the rest of us were all serfs. And now it's the corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And the corporations are not interested in our health. They are interested in making money.
Mm-hmm.
That's a real perversion. And I think we need to get a hold of that. I think that the people need to revoke the corporation's charter to do business on their land if they continue with this making money being the bottom line instead of the health of the people.
Mm-hmm. Could you define, I think what's important too, is that we need to redefine what is wealth. And I'm wondering if you could define wealth from an Indigenous perspective. How do we really adopt the decolonized mindset that doesn't perceive land ownership as a form of wealth? How do you see that happening, this redefining of wealth?
I think true wealth is when your children love you. And when other children look to you and want to listen to you and are learning something from you. And when your community loves what you offer your community, that's wealth, because you could own so much and be miserable, mm-hmm. and be unloved. And that's not well.
Technology, as we know, dominates much of modern life as well. And I wonder, do you find that Indigenous youth are seeking after their ancestors and heritage more? What are you finding for yourself in this embrace of technology and at the same time being able to honor Indigenous life ways? I mean,
the technology can be a great asset to youth. You can go online and learn how to make a dugout canoe, or you can learn your language online. Anytime somebody says to me, I'm part Native, I'm like, wow, what's your tribe? And have you learned some words in your language? So technology can really help. And there are a lot of young people that are really embracing their culture. There's a great gathering that used to happen in Michigan, the Great Lakes Traditional Arts Gathering. And that was a real Native, non-Native collaboration. But you went there and camped out in this gorgeous place, and you could learn to make birch bark etchings. You could make bark baskets. You could learn to throw atlatls. You could get some cultural teachings from some elders. Those kinds of opportunities need to be funded. It's usually just a couple of people that make things like that happen.
You know, in your journey to understand your peoples and traditions, were you able to reclaim your language? You know, in one of your videos, you mentioned the decline in the number of Native languages spoken, and it had gone down from like 250 in 1994 to 150 in 2020. But we know that there are stories of languages coming back, even if there are very, very few Native speakers. I know there's was an incredible program at UC Berkeley that was helping with that. And what are your insights about the restoration of language? Because that is the way we see the world.
It is so important because, like you said, it is the worldview. It holds the worldview. Since I'm in contact with Mohawk people and Abenaki people and Anishinaabe people, I've learned a few words from each language. Mm-hmm. And I would love to learn the Narragansett language, but I haven't figured out how to do that. Like with the Abenaki, they are very open to having people learn their language. In fact, they're having some of the signs, the road signs, changed into Abenaki now, mm-hmm. for everybody. So they have CDs and they have an online website. They have an online website, you know, as far as my language, Narragansett. Well, I just haven't found it. I mean, I have lists of words, but if there was a language class, I don't know that I would be welcome to come to it. So, you know, I had that the way I've done it, this has been on my mind for years as I want to learn my indigenous language. But what's coming to me is a little bit of each of the ones around me.
Do you think that it would be a welcome change? Because what are the choices? You know, you have a language that dies out, or you may have other people speaking it who are not the native peoples.
I think what's happened in the past is that non-native people would then become the experts about native people. So that's why, like, at this time, my understanding with the Wampanoag language is they're not open to having non-native people or non-Wampanoag people speak that language. There's right. just issues of appropriation, whose language it is. And these are just complexities that I feel like they're just going to have to iron out. They just got to work their ways out.
Exactly. Yeah. There's no like one singular way, but it's just being able to actually converse about it and ponder that, the realities of keeping the language alive and keeping culture alive. And
it just, the respect needs to happen there. It's like Linda Coombs said, respect comes before understanding. Mm-hmm. You have to start out by realizing what you don't know, by having that humility. Okay, just because I see the language this way, maybe it's not the way it's spoken. So there has to be a respect toward Native people. And I think if we get rid of the seal and the flag and the mascots and start to understand that the Native people are still here, and that, yes, there's federally recognized, state recognized descendant groups, we get just a step further to, I wonder if there is a way to learn the language. I mean, the Abenaki, they're really coming along with it. But that being said, there's Abenaki, more northern Abenaki, who resent the southern Abenaki. So it's just kind of messy that way. But you know, we'll just keep plugging along.
Yeah,
I think they're getting better.
Exactly. It's all a progression. Shows like Reservation Dogs and Rutherford Falls are bringing Native peoples more to the forefront in their authentic expression, their creativity and culture in ways that are just more globally seen now. It's kind of a phenomenon. And does it encourage you that Indigenous peoples are getting more media exposure on their own terms?
Absolutely. And I've been trying to figure out how to get Aboriginal People's Television Network here in the United States. You can only get it from Canada. But mm-hmm. some of those programs look like, oh boy, that's really what I want to watch. Those ones that you mentioned, I haven't ever seen. Mm-hmm. I don't have TV. I get, you know, mm-hmm. DVDs by the mail. And there have been some really good movies about Native people, by Native people, but not enough of them. You mm-hmm. know, I mean, there's the movie We Still Live Here is the story of the Wampanoag language reclaiming, which is really wonderful.
I think we're going to continue to see more of this, though. And as it kind of like you have these shows on Netflix or Hulu and Epic, that the next step is, you know, you see feature films, you see bigger things it becomes more broad based. More and more people are being exposed to peoples that they may never have engaged with or had any other kind of perspective about other than from their own head. You know, so it's wonderful to have Native peoples tell their own stories. We need to see more of. It's all about this relational piece of remembering the Native peoples are here. They're very much alive, and it's about them thriving again. You know, you've stated that approximately 2% of all land on this continent belongs to Native peoples at this point, you know, in this titling way. But I think a lot of people also don't know that reservations are actually owned by the federal government. And it seems the first place for lands to be returned so that the reservations are actually owned by the tribes themselves. I don't know what is happening in this regard, if anything is. I really wasn't even aware that the First Nations didn't own their own reservations.
Yeah, that's a very different way of looking at land, isn't it?
But then you have this contradiction, because it's like you don't believe in owning the land, but at the same time, you know, how does this change?
Some of the Eastern tribes are rebuying back their land, I'm not really up on the different ways. There's the trust way. There's the simple way. Some people just want access. So it's an important issue. The land is, and the land is why things happened the way they did. The acquiring of resources, the extracting of resources, that's why things happened the way they did. But I'm hoping that Native people can get more and more reconnected to their land, their food, and that non-Native people have an understanding, just have a better understanding. I wanted to just relate a little bit about the arts that are happening on the East, the ones that I know about. We are remaking dugout canoes, birch bark canoes. We have beautiful quill work on birch bark, wampum jewelry. Our regalia is changing from a pan-Indian style to a specifically Northeastern style. These kinds of things are happening, which is, to me, very encouraging.
You know, if you could speak about how people can connect with you. We actually didn't speak a lot about Nolumbika project and what programs you're doing there. But if you could give listeners a way to connect with the resources of Nolumbika, the projects and programs that you're engaged with through that project.
Okay. So NolumbikaProject.org. And if you go to there, it has the different events. So one of the events that they have is every year we invite Native people to come back and sell their wares along the river in what used to be an intertribal shared village place of fishing. And so we made up this movie series that are interviews with a couple of really esteemed elders and some educators and artisans. They're short videos. They are there on the Nolumbika website. They're free to everyone. We made them with the hopes that the schools would use them. And yesterday we had Holyoke Community College using the movie series and the Deerfield Elementary School using part of the movie series.
The Indigenous Voices film series, correct?
Yes. Yes.
And Jennifer, what about for your bark basket making there? You also have a connection point for that too. Do you want to share that with listeners?
Sure. Barkbasketsbyjaylee.com. And you can look at some of the bark baskets.
And listeners, definitely look at Nolumbika project and all of the incredible programs that they're offering and how they are keeping the resources alive so that you can also learn more about the histories of the Northeast First Nations. Jennifer, thank you so much for coming on today and for being the storyteller that you are, because you are holding the stories of so much that has happened here. And it's important for our youth. It's important for all of us in order to keep moving forward to that better world that is possible.
You're so welcome. Thank you so much for asking me to join you. And it's great to meet you. And I love the work that you're doing.
This has been Eco Justice Radio and our show, Indigenous Voices from the Northeast, Past, Present, and Future. Thank you to our guest, Jennifer Lee, and thank you to our listeners for joining us. Please connect with us on social media at Eco Justice Radio SoCal350 and Adventures in Waste. If you like what you heard and you want others to be informed, subscribe and share the episodes. You have been listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350. Executive producer Jack Eit, producer and co-host Jessica Aldridge, co-host Carrie Kim, and engineer and original music by Blake Quake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours. Hey, oh, no, no, no.
listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
On the next episode of Voices for the Animals, we'll look into the case of a goat, a girl, and the rise of more compassionate and humane alternatives to 4-H agricultural programs. We'll be speaking with Danielle Hanisch, Executive Director of LEAP, Leaders for Ethics, Animals, and the Planet. It's a program that offers students the farm animal care experience and opportunities of 4-H without the selling of those animals for slaughter, which can traumatize many kids.
These kids were, you know, 14, 15, 16 years old and just realizing, like someone flipped a switch, that, oh my gosh, these animals are no different than my dogs and cats at home. And now I'm knee-deep in this program and I don't think that there's another option, and I have to betray my friend who I have cared for.